Hello, I'm Tahir Kiran, and you're listening to Poetic Synergy, a program that explores Eastern influences on the work of some Irish poets. Later on, I'll be meeting with a group of panelists who will explore these Eastern influences on this particular poet's work. Today, I'm in the company of Gabriel Rosenstock, and Gabriel, you're very welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Di. I do believe it all started well before I was born. In fact, perhaps the greatest insight that the East has given to me is that I was never born. And one of the great modern gurus of India, Rajneesh, later known as Osho, his Fartli, as we say in Irish, his epitaph is Osho, never born, never died. But in physical temporal terms, when did I realise that the East would be full of promise for me? Possibly I had a sense of unease for many years growing up and wondering, you know, about the nature of reality. Even something like the Irish language opened up the possibilities of the other, and I like to put a capital O on that other. In other words, another reality, another way of looking at the world, and if you like, another way of undermining concepts that existed about the world and that were accepted or that were drummed into. And so I suppose coming to the East was a process very much of unlearning a lot of what I had grown up with. I was drawn towards the East on two or three different levels. One level, I was interested in the human condition and wanted to find out, you know, how it existed in different manifestations and how people ate differently, prayed differently, made love differently, or whatever we do in life. Secondly, I always have had a voracious appetite for literature, and I wanted to see what the other half of the world was writing and reading and reciting and singing. And thirdly, there was the spiritual dimension. I was spiritually very restless growing up. I didn't really like the Christian icons that surrounded me. I hope this isn't shocking to anybody, especially people of faith, but I didn't like Christ on the cross. And when I saw other manifestations of the divine that were more, if you like, attuned with joy and with ecstasy rather than with suffering, I gravitated towards them, and I became attracted to various other types of icons, maybe the Buddha, maybe Krishna, until ultimately, of course, I found that one can go beyond icons and even beyond the word, and this is when I then finally discovered what's called Advaita or non-duality.
So I wonder what it was like for you as a person that you were dissatisfied with the image of Christ suffering, and then you became a person that explored that you could sing another song. Could you just tell us a small bit about what the process of that was like for you both as a person and as a developing poet?
You see, in a way, the mission of Christ and the mission of the Buddha is very similar. Christ, if you like, suffered so that mankind would be cleansed of original sin. Now, the Buddha, too, was interested in suffering, but he was interested in understanding the nature of suffering. And he understood the nature of suffering to be connected with the ego. And the ego is one of the strongest components of human creation. It is the ego that stirs desire, looks for pleasure, for fame. So by his great act of meditation on the nature of suffering, you could say that Buddha conquered pain, Buddha conquered suffering. And so that smile that we see on the Buddha's face, that, I think, you know, is more appealing to me as a human being than the bloodied body of Christ.
And on this path where you have to drop the ego and you have to go beyond words, like, that's very interesting for a poet to go on such a journey, because in some sense you're driven by an ego to express, and you have to go on this path of unlearning to quietness beyond words. What was that like as an experience for you?
Well, you know, in a sense, if you come to a complete understanding of the nature of the self, then the desire to express oneself will wane. So you must also, I think, pay respect to your own nature as a poet as well, if you happen to be a poet. My work is diverse, and I write prose, I write poetry, I also write haiku. And haiku is not poetry. Haiku is a discipline of itself. And I think that haiku, at its purest form, moves towards the nature of silence and arises from silence and drifts away into silence and leaves the reader with a feeling of the silence of the universe, that silence before and after birdsong, if you like. You see, my favourite haikuist, Issa, the Japanese master, he has one fantastic haiku which says, "Falling from my heart, the snows of Shinano." Now, Shinano, his native area, is a very snowy, mountainy area. And what he says in this wonderful haiku, he expresses, I believe, non-duality. In other words, what is outside is inside. What is inside is outside. There is no distinction anymore in his purified consciousness between out and in, between what he sees and what he is, because he is composing this haiku from a level of universal consciousness. "Falling from my heart, the snows of Shinano."
So your journey is a journey of becoming and becoming one. And so for you, in the context of this program, as an Irish person who was brought up in Ireland, you have become one with the world, one with yourself, and one with the universe. Would you say this has been a synergistic aspect of your journey?
When you say my journey is one of becoming, that, you know, implies some kind of an evolution. Sometimes I think I'm actually not evolving at all, I'm devolving. I'm becoming that horse I was in the 14th century. I don't know if it's really, are we talking about becoming as really an isness? Of an awareness of an isness, this consciousness, this awareness of it, of isness, of the eternal I, would inform my poetry and my haiku, but not always. One can, as it were, occupy other levels of consciousness as well.
So, would you say that your song is the song of isness, and that you, as an artist, have explored the eternal that exists within us and the godliness that exists within each one of us as potential people to be in the dimension of being?
I suppose the only way I could explain that or answer that would be to give you a poem. I was watching a black and white documentary about an African tribe. They were called pygmies then. Maybe there's a more politically correct word today. And they were out hunting elephants. But I was absorbed, of course, at that particular time, Indian mythology and Ganesh, one of the gods, the elephant-headed god, and listening to mantras and chants and sacred songs. So the poem that came to me, I had the title immediately, and it was called Omos, Homage. But there, even in the word Omos, you had the what's called the Bij mantra, the seed mantra there, Om, the sacred sound, which some people believe is actually the last whimper of the Big Bang. But anyway, here's the poem. Nilin chid an elephant nach nihin a pygmehe Shri Ganesha nama Pyrkan shida machan smurris alpen ave Shri Ganesha nama Nilin chid an duffer nach grihin agen traskert Shri Ganesha nama Conan boss na elephant an vah, shadianigi ariloga gardas is a rian aside the tree om Shri Ganesha yanama. Is gaule deer an elephant, is gaule shliev, is gaule tornach, preen could starry a clun down, savilan, Shri Ganesha yanama. Sha ihemish was all a mish ashta, shahes musach de om Shri Ganesha yanama. There's no part of the elephant that the pygmies will not eat. Shri Ganesha Nama. They gouge out the marrow and swallow it raw. Shri Ganesha Nama. There's no part of the jungle that doesn't quake at this downfall. Shri Ganesha Nama. The elephant's death is the song of life. Come, leaves, and celebrate. With the sun arrowing through you, Om Shri Ganesha Yanama. The elephant is like a god, like a mountain, like thunder. Its tusks bear the earth's weight and all it contains. Shri Ganesha Yanama, come, let us eat and drink of it. This is the core of God. Om Shri Ganesha Yanama.
I'm joined by Paddy Bush, poet, by writer Alan Titley, and by poet and member of Éastána, Cathal Ó-Sharkaigh. Just to get us going, because Gabriel has brought us on quite a journey there, the one thing I'd like to explore first is the breaking out of cultural parameters or brackets. It's something that really struck me about Gabriel, particularly when I spoke about being on a journey and developing and evolving. And Gabriel said, no, there's an aspect of the eternal to him as a person and as a poet. In terms of the synergy, what do you feel that he has brought to us?
I think the great thing about Gabriel, I mean, two things I would say. One is astonishment at what he has done, and astonishment at the continual high standard of poetry, which is quite different from just about everybody else writing in Irish. And the other one is a kind of a gratitude for introducing us to a whole range of poetry that we probably wouldn't have written or wouldn't have read otherwise. And I think what's amazing about him is that, you know, when people think of Irish poetry, and I'm using the phrase Irish poetry in Irish in this case for a shortcut, you know, we think of maybe the west of Ireland, we think of the tradition, we think of people trying to link into the dead generations, and people are going west, if you want to use it as a metaphor. And what Gabriel did, he went east instead of that. And of course, Irish is often think is we're told is an Indo-European language, and it was part of this great language family for thousands of years. There's the academic hat coming up, but I won't pursue this too much. And of course, we're on the western end of the Indo-European. And of course, what Gabriel is doing is going to the eastern end of the Indo-European. So we're part of all that. So I said it's that kind of astonishment at what he's done. I suppose what poets do and writers do is they try to find other writers that are not so much like themselves, but speak to their imagination, speak to a part of their imagination that sometimes didn't really know that they had. And I think Gabriel, in his investigations, came across these people and he found that he was part of that as well.
And Paddy, I think that'll be a nice link for you, because you're somebody who poets from the East have spoken to. What do you hear that has been spoken through the medium of Gabriel?
Well, I think Gabriel's energy, his openness, you know, I would endorse everything that Alan has said there. You know, I don't necessarily share, in fact, I don't at all share the philosophical belief behind his work, but neither do I with lots of Christian poetry either, which I can appreciate. But his openness in dealing with the whole world, particularly with the East, I think is an enormously energizing force in Irish poetry and in Irish language poetry. And his openness to translation from other languages, that, and, you know, his sheer energy, you know, which is awesome, as people say nowadays, is mind-boggling. And how he keeps it up, I don't know. You know, and he does it with constant good humour and constant seriousness, which is a great combination.
And for you, Cathal?
Well, Gabriel is an extraordinary presence where East and West meet in a full benediction of the word. He wants to sap us with holiness. He wants to levitate us with joy. He wants to clothe us with light. The first time I came across Gabriel was many, many years ago. As a teenager, I stumbled across poems of his in the pages of the Irish language magazine Core, and a Gaelic door was opened to me onto life. It was a liberating doorway. You know, here I came across a poet who was a tuned-in cosmopolitan with strong roots in the Gaelic Dúas. And the poems, and I remember them yet, there was a wonderful poem, celebration of Ravi Shankar. There was a poem titled Tiptoe Through the Tulips, a homage to Tiny Tim. And these poems at the time, for me anyway, they debunked the received vision of reality that I was getting at school. I loved their impish humour, their openness to the unexpected and the unpredictable. For me, they were messages in a bottle to a large extent from some distant Chir na n-og, a revitalized Gaelic Ireland that flourished defiant and free on the margins of English. That was very affirming for a young poet like myself. And I remember shortly afterwards begun to publish and a writer in Irish called Richard O'Glashner, a critic, wrote this essay about my early poems in the magazine called Antolta. And he had this very grandiose title, Cahalo Sharkey, Columbus the Ille, Cahalo Sharkey, a Columbus of a poet. And very soon after that, I got a book of Japanese poetry from Gabriel with the inscription on it, Do Christopher Columbus o Yuri Gagarin, for Christopher Columbus from Yuri Gagarin. And to a large extent, that epitomizes what Gabriel is all about. While we were, you know, earthbound and terrestrial, there was Gabriel, like Yuri Gagarin, out embracing the cosmos. And that's what he does in his work.
And you said he opened the Gaelic door and a light came through for you. There's a lot of light in Gabriel's work. I just wonder, could we explore that for a few minutes?
Yes, indeed. In fact, one of the things that I'm reflecting on is that a great deal of Irish poetry of the 18th, 19th century, it's very much oral poetry. In other words, it's word music, and it is the sound of the language that often has its impact. A poet like Owen Roe Sullivan, who I think is a great poet, but a lot of his poetry is simply word music, and you can kind of be washed in that. Gabriel is much more visual, in the sense that I think a lot of his poems are like laser beams. You're sitting there, you're reading something, you say, God, I never saw that. And I think because he in fact, I suppose, almost single-handedly brought the haiku into Irish as well, and he's a great haikuist, and I heard him saying earlier, haiku isn't a poem as such, but I'm not sure what it is, but it's a gleam of light, and there's that kind of silence around it. And many of the poems he has, you read it, and you can't read them quickly. You read them and you stand back and you see what they said, and then you say, yeah, that's true, I never saw it that way before. And it's that kind of vision, and it is visionary in that sense. So it is light, there is lightness, there is brightness, they're surrounded by silence, but they're sharp, and it's that sharpness that helps us to see all the more, having read his poetry or heard his poetry.
And Paddy, I wonder, Alan talked about a gleam of light that Gabriel brought with his work. You as a poet have a collection, Gillen and Gwille, which is like, you know, light of light or crystal of crystal or brightness of brightness. Just for you as somebody who is immersed in Irish poetry, working with light, what strikes you about the light in Gabriel's work?
Well, what strikes me is what I think is necessary. If you're going to have light in your poetry, you must do it with an awareness of darkness, because, one way of defining light is an absence of darkness. And, while Gabriel is somebody whose poetry would be generally thought to have an affirmative tone, he's somebody also who's very aware of the darkness that lies behind that. You know, one particular haiku, at the foot of the cross, a blood-stained snail becomes a Buddha. Okay, it's a type of enlightenment, but it's done against a background and in the midst of darkness, the cultural accretions of everything to do with the crucifixion and the darkness and whatever. And that light as an antidote to darkness, or, you know, I mean, that's maybe the philosophical position, but an awareness of darkness and to write it in that condition gives it a realism, and it becomes something necessary for us.
Cathal, I wonder, could you have a look at, we've explored darkness now and silence, and I wonder what strikes you from Gabriel's work? So you talked about opening doors and opening out to the cosmos. And of course, in the cosmos, there is darkness and there is silence. I'm wondering, could you explore that for us, please?
Well, through the haiku particularly, you know, I think the haiku, and Gabriel himself mentioned silence, and he associated the haiku coming out of silence, an oriental silence. Haiku is a type of poem that is balanced, pure, tranquil, I think it calms the mind when one reads the haiku. It thrives on the nourishing properties of silence. After all, the whole of the cosmos is encapsulated in 17 syllables. And for the haiku, it's a question of seeing, you know, seeing clearly what is under your nose. Talk about one of Gabriel's haikus. In Irish, it goes like this. Blaha evasa, shulan kat, chirigari lum. Flowers in a vase. The cat walks through a bare garden. The sense of care and compassion in that. It does open a window onto its sympathy.
Yeah. I disagree a bit with Cathal about necessarily tranquility or the whole cosmos being in a haiku. I know it aims at that sort of effect, but I suppose I look at it as the poem that results, you know, I think a haiku is a poem, from a meditative process. This one, for example, a magpie sipping beakfuls of its latest image. You know, to me, that's, you know, a wonderful picture, and that's what it is. I don't see anything cosmic in it. You know, we could walk out of the building here and see it along the quays, and it would be wonderful.
Yeah. And the awful thing is, you have to stop and think. You know, there's a lot of poetry you can read and you get it straight away. And it's not that they're difficult, but you know there's a lot more happening. There's a kind of a glow around the poetry that you wouldn't get otherwise. And the one that Paddy read earlier about the snail and the drop of blood from the cross. Mm. I mean, I'm not sure what that's about, but I'm kind of wrestle with it and thinking about it. And there's something powerful about it. But then, as you were saying, the darkness is there as well. He's a haiku about, because he's visited India many times, as far as I'm aware, Mumbai, rags on a pavement, a body stores in them. And there you get, you know, you have a great deal about world poverty, just like that, in one short number of words.
One thing I like about these haikus, and I think it's true of all haikus, but particularly in Gabriel's, is that attentiveness. You know, you have to have a certain set of mind to see things. The word for poet in Irish, of course, is fille, and it means, comes from the word fishkin, to see, or to see clearly what other people have forgotten to see. Krishnamurti, I think, was a huge influence on Gabriel and has been a huge influence on a lot of us, I think, who write poetry in Irish. At the heart of Krishnamurti's wisdom is this idea that you have to be open to have the capacity of meeting everything anew from moment to moment without the conditioning reaction of the past. And that's what I like so much about Gabriel's work. Right from the beginning, it's debunking the received vision of reality that we are accustomed to.
We were talking about Gabriel's humour as well. In the middle of these haikus, and they're very poignant and they can be very strong. And then he has another one about just about ordinary things, and there's nothing mystical about it. In fact, if we lower the tone for a moment, he has one about which goes, sheep droppings, a baker's dozen, each one the same. Now, I can't speak with any great authority. I don't think they're actually each one is the same, but it gets you to think about them. Gets you to think about
bring
them anyway.
To the vet
and I'm inclined to agree with Paddy in the sense of he's saying, I don't care so much about the philosophy because in whatever philosophy I have, it's much more a Western philosophy. And, you know, again, because that was the way I was brought up. And it was, I like Christian iconography, the more garish and the more bloodthirsty, the better. That happens to the kind of imagination I have. But that has nothing to do with what Gabriel is. So Gabriel is a different way of looking at it. And the poetry is supported by this philosophy, but the philosophy itself, I don't think, is that important. You know, you get the poems without, but if you want the philosophy, you can get that as well.
I wonder, is that something that Gabriel brings from Ireland to his work and from his own personality across to the East? Is this irreverent humour? Because you talk about the sheep droppings, and he also says there are blackberries, the puka shaton. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this man who brings us out to deep philosophical views of the cosmos, he actually engages the ordinariness through irreverence as well.
I think that's very much part of it. And it's, you know, I don't think you'd have poetry unless the philosophy, the mysticism, whatever, was brought into some kind of comprehensible form. First of all, for the writer than is for the reader of poetry who may not share it. And, you know, Gabriel does that through, you know, Krishnamurti becomes Krishnamurfi.
That's right.
Which is a wonderful concept. It's funny, but it's very serious at the same time. And that one you mentioned about the Buddha, you know, has the Eastern mysticism, and then it's the Pooka, the chat on the blackberries. There's a very fine poem called Mustanabe, you know, which has a Bedouin protagonist. If I might just read a few lines. I have long forgotten what signs I must watch for. In Kerry I whined like a pup. In Tipperary I spoke like a wolf. In Kildare like a hunting beagle, like a gentle hound at the border. At a golf course in Clare, a politician showed his teeth to me. So, you know, the whole thing is brought into contemporary Ireland, deeply serious, funny, and the two worlds coexist. Because as far as the poetry is concerned, unless the two worlds are made to coexist in a way that speaks to the reader, not necessarily philosophically, but it speaks to the reader imaginatively, it wouldn't work as poetry.
I have a quotation that might bring our exploration of Gabriel's synergistic energy to a conclusion. I think 'tis Liam O'Murhella said that as Irish people, there's a sense of being offshore and that we're journeying just to stay there or to stay here. I just wonder, in some sense, has Gabriel's exploration and journeying achieved that for both himself as a person and for Irish poetry?
Well, I think the fact that he writes in Irish, largely in Irish, means that we are here and we have that kind of safety net of just being here, and there's nothing that can be done about that. That's the way it is. But the fact then that he has travelled so far abroad in all kinds of directions, and it brings us back to us. So there's an entire universe. What I would simply say, we are wiser because of what Gabriel Rosenstock has done for us. And for that, I'm grateful.
Yeah, to hark back to Liam's quotation, I'd simply say briefly that Gabriel stays everywhere, and long may he do so.
And for me, Gabriel Rosenstock is the Johnny Appleseed of Gaelic literature. You know, Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, the American who planted apple trees all over the New England states. Well, you know, Gabriel, by the generosity of his imagination, has scattered many seeds that all of us engaged in Gaelic or in literature in Ireland have benefited from. He has been an encourager, giving counsel, giving guidance, giving suggestions. He has helped all of us.
Alan, Paddy and Kyle, thank you so much.